Riddle me this, pod fans. What's 90 Minutes Long arrives every Friday and all about the Caped Crusader? Why, it's Blabbing About Batman, the animated series, the newest Patreon-exclusive podcast miniseries on the Talking Simpsons Network.
That's right. For the rest of 2022, we'll be covering eight of our favorite episodes of Batman, the animated series, with the same heavy-duty research, clips, and trivia you've come to expect from us. And if you sign up at the $5 level today at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, you'll get to hear each episode as soon as it goes live.
Remember, sign up at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons to hear all eight episodes of Blabbing About Batman, the animated series, as well as the 100-plus other exclusive podcast episodes we produced so far. So become a patron and join us through the rest of 2022 for another great miniseries. Same Bat Day, same Bat Podcast Feed.
Ghost, what I'm scared of the most. Can you scare me up a little bit of love? I'm the only one that sees you, and I can't do much to please you, and it's knocking down to meet the Lord above.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this month's free preview of our What a Cartoon Movie episode all about Paranorman. I am one of your hosts, the spicy hummus enjoyer, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today, as always.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and I'm still terrified of toilet paper zombies.
We all should be, and yes, this month for our What a Cartoon Movie podcast, we're calling this our Halloween Hangover Month. And instead of doing a seasonally appropriate movie like Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, no, thank you, we are covering Paranorman. We left it up to our listeners to vote on which 2012 kids' horror movie they wanted to pick, and they picked Paranorman, and it was the best pick because this is an amazing movie, and if you haven't seen it, buddy, you need to. And also, listen to our podcast as well.
Yeah, me and Bob had never really experienced it before either, and it's our first Laika movie that we've covered for What a Cartoon Podcast, and once we did it, I was like, wow, this was long overdue. I'm so glad our listeners chose this movie to do, because yeah, it was so... I mean, it's just amazing craft of stop motion animation, and it has a story and jokes that you do not see in most kids' things that I think is a good lesson for kids to learn.
You're going to hear the word hell. You're going to hear the word damnation. You're going to hear the word pissed.
Pissed. Yeah, you're going to see close-ups of a big old butt on screen.
A kid's going to play with a corpse for like 60 seconds. It's great. But if you want to hear the rest of this entire 5-plus hour podcast, please head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up for $10 a month. You'll get to hear the rest of this podcast and also our entire catalog, 4 entire years of What a Cartoon Movie podcast, between 3- and 5-hour long podcasts stretching back to 2018. So many things are there. We've got a movies about most of the Disney Renaissance has been covered so far. We've covered most of the Toy Story movies. We've covered oddball movies like Beavis and Butthead Do America, Beavis and Butthead Do the Universe, Rocko's Modern Life, Static Clean. We got anime in there like Akira and Kiki's Delivery Service and Castle Cagliostro. You name it, we probably covered it, and if we haven't, we will very, very soon.
Yeah, there's a ton of great stuff coming your way over 250 hours of What a Cartoon Movies, and that's in addition to all of the awesome $5 stuff that we have that you'll also get as part of your $10 subscription, which right now includes weekly episodes until the end of 2022 of Blabbing About Batman, the animated series, where we're going through 8 more of our favorite episodes, plus monthly episodes of Talking Futurama, Talking of the Hill, and a back catalog that includes us covering every episode of The Critic and Mission Hill.
And again, that's all happening for subscribers at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. That's it for this little intro. Now on to the free preview of our What a Cartoon Movie podcast all about Paranorman. But Laika actually begins with the story of Will Vinton Productions, and we'll go into much more detail about that studio when we cover one of their works. But I do want to give the broad strokes about Will Vinton and his studio and how it became Laika. And it's kind of an ugly story. But then it's conflicting because there are not great actors involved, but then everything Laika makes is pretty good.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to think in the end.
It does seem a little complicated from the little I read not too long ago. I had never heard this before about Laika. I guess I should have realized a bit of this because after doing the research on Nightmare Before Christmas, you learn of like that all those people worked on Gumby, and then several, many of them moved over to Laika. It's like, in America, there are only so many people who know how to do stop motion. So if a brand new studio like Leica opens up, it has to have roots in some other place, because it's like with that Phil Tippett movie we did on Struggle Session as well, of just like, yeah, these have to be taught to you by like basically a mage who's like, well, I mastered this stop motion art and now I shall teach you. Like, you can't just learn it at school.
And it's all happening outside of Hollywood, because Phil Tippett made Mad God in the Bay Area.
Yeah,
I think
Berkeley,
like Berkeley,
just down the street from here. Yeah.
And then Leica is outside of Portland. And then there's Aardman, who still is in the UK.
Yeah,
so none of this is really happening in Hollywood.
And Nightmare Before Christmas was produced in SF as well.
Yeah, that's
with
right.
The Selick hiring a bunch of the guys he knew from the 80s Gumby. Yeah.
That's true. So yeah, it's all happening outside of LA. So Will Vinton Productions. Let's talk about Will Vinton, a name you should be familiar with, but if not, here's a brief history. So before going solo, UC Berkeley graduate and stop motion animator Will Vinton won the Oscar for Best Animated Short Film in 1975 for Closed Mondays. This is on YouTube. It's about a drunk who wanders into a closed art gallery and sort of like interacts with all of the art pieces around him in a fun and imaginative way.
That's cool.
This won the Oscar in 1975. He made this with his former creative partner, Bob Gardner. And before this, Vinton made documentaries about, you know, the rise of the counterculture movement, because he was in Berkeley in the late 60s. He went to UC Berkeley in the late 60s and he got a degree in architecture. And yeah. He ends up being a stop motion animator, which I think there are some skills that transfer, because architecture, you're building things, and also you're also building things in stop motion.
You have to plan it out very carefully. You have to take your time. And I guess too, one little mistake can cost you a whole bunch of money. So you got to like not measure twice and cut once, but measure like 7,000
yes.
times and then cut once.
That is his philosophy, I think, when he was alive. So,
which that's also a fun structure of like you're explaining to me like a Berkeley hippie guy who came up in, you know, like the summer of love and Nixon and Watergate and all that, and then he becomes, you know, the father of American stop motion or. Well, no, I guess that's our clokey, but a major player in media.
He was animated in Annoyed and the California Raisin stuff. We'll get to that, though. So he founds Will Vinton Productions in the late 70s. We don't have time to go over everything here, but the output from the studio's early years feels mostly unknown to everyone, including me. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things they've done that I just encountered for the first time. So we know the studio more for their TV and advertising work. We know the California Raisins. We know the Noid. We know the Michael Jackson video that he did with like the Michael Jackson rabbit dancing around. That's a great video.
I think
it's Leave Me Alone. Is that it?
Yes. Okay. Don't stop having me around. Yeah. No, every time I saw a Will Vinton, I didn't know it, but every time I saw one of those commercials, I just stopped. Like, I loved the California Raisins. It was partially helped by Hardee's, where I grew up. It was more of a regional fast food chain then. Now it's Hardee's and Carl's Jr. But they did a thing with the California Raisins, like it was like raisin biscuits or something, and then the thing was they gave away California Raisins like toys, little stuffed guys, and my mom is a big collector of fast food toys, and so I had those too, and I was like, oh my god, it was such superstars. I had the California Raisins to play with all the time.
They made so many of those. I see them everywhere at retro conventions.
It's them and Alf hand puppets right
yes.
next to each other. Yeah.
But yeah, actually the Michael Jackson video was Speed Demon. Leave Me Alone might have been Aardman or someone else.
Right that was also stop motion, but you're right that it's also in the same Moonwalker movie
yes.
thing, but yeah, I got it mixed up.
Only the music videos are good in Moonwalker, but also never watch it again. It's cursed like the Ring tape, so don't watch it.
Oh, God.
We know them from the California Raisins. We know them from the Noid, Will Vinton Productions. But their early years saw them making plenty of shorts for Oscar consideration. And I feel like it's still, I mean, post YouTube, it's not as hard. But for the longest time, you couldn't really see the shorts that were being made for Oscars. You could go to conventions and you could go to like film festivals. But if you lived in a small town, you would never see them, even the ones Disney made.
Yeah.
But they were trying to win Oscars with their shorts.
It was a thing every year watching the Oscars that you would see the one short that, like, you know, the Pixar short that played before the Pixar movie you saw. And then you would see, you know, 3 seconds of some other short you've never heard of and could never watch, and they're like, well, I wonder if that was good or not. I don't know.
It's like, did you go to Spike and Mike's Sick and Twisted Animation Festival? No, I'm 10. Yeah. I live in Youngstown, Ohio.
It's, you know, there's lots of stuff people can complain about today, but the availability of all these animated shorts, like, instantly online is really much better than things used to be.
And yeah, he was making Oscar shorts. I don't think he won another Oscar. I could be wrong about that. But he was also a savvy businessman, and he trademarked the term claymation. Mm-hmm. And I think for the longest time, until recently, maybe some older people still do it, but anytime they see stop motion, they call it claymation. And that's probably because of Will Vinton.
Absolutely. I on this podcast, listeners have heard me live deprogram myself from saying claymation when I mean stop motion. I think it was after we did a couple Wallace and Gromits that when I was like, no, it's stop motion.
I think Will Vinton would have preferred that too, because I used to be a very likable stickler, and I would say, no, claymation only refers to a Will Vinton production. Gumby is not claymation. And actually, Aardman uses plasticine, so you're wrong.
Claymation is such a great word, though, too. Like, it's way better than Japanimation.
I agree. Let's not say that again. So let's get to where Henry and I really know Will Vinton from. Advertising, of course. We talked about the Noid. Actually, I just did a live panel for Retronauts going over the history of food mascot games, and I watched a lot of those Noid commercials, and they're all so nice and fun. Mm. And California Raisins. And in its CGI era, I forgot about this, Will Vinton's productions had a CGI era, and they actually created the M&M characters that still exist today.
They did? Wow.
Yeah, that's Will Vinton.
I didn't know that. Wow. Yeah. And then it turned into, oh, wow, that's amazing. I see the Will Vintonness in their designs. Yeah, this is something for younger people, like, here's old man quarter. But
40-year-old men are talking. Everyone be quiet.
But if you wonder, like, look, yes, we were heavily advertised to as kids, and that is why we liked all these mascots and stuff. But I will say things like the Noid, the California Raisins, I'd also say Cool Spot. Things like that.
Chester Cheetah.
A lot of them had cutting edge animation stuff you couldn't see in movies. So it's like, you know, we all thought the Cool Spot looked neat and everything, or the Pillsbury Doughboy. But what I think we were really responding to was we'd never seen CGI before. So just seeing a 7-Up dot fall off of a glass and dance around, like, that made you go, like, I want to play a whole video game starring this character.
Yeah, the 7-Up commercials were like mini Roger Rabbits, basically, where the spots were existing within a real world, interacting with things in the real world.
Yeah, now, you know, that was back when commercials were pretty much the cutting edge of all this stuff that you would eventually see on a theatrical level, but couldn't be pulled off for, you know, 10 or even 20 years in some cases.
Yeah, Pixar was doing commercials and logos. It was a way for these people to test out different techniques and also make a lot of money selling marketable characters, too.
You make a marketable... I mean, this is how capitalism shapes everything, isn't it?
But, yes. So, to be fair, the studio peaked in popularity between the late 80s and the early 90s with some primetime California Raisin specials. They won an Emmy with their Christmas and Easter specials, beating Radio Bart with the latter. And the Simpsons people are still mad about it.
Still mad,
yes.
Yeah.
But they shouldn't be mad, because I totally forgot that Homer versus Lisa and the Eighth Commandment beat Will Vinton's Halloween special that year. So it was like Christmas won, and then the Simpsons beat them, and then they won again.
You know, it's only fair then. Trade it back and forth. Will Vinton... You know, the Simpson guys are still doing well these days. They don't need to be mad. And man, that Christmas special, that was in the same level as all the other ones I watched a million times.
Me too. Yeah. I think it's not as well remembered, and we should do it next year for What a Cartoon.
For sure. Yeah. I think, it was. I mean, I was brought in by seeing just the Raisins in the commercials. So they're going to sing Rudolph, a fun Rudolph, not the real Rudolph, but then all the other stuff is like, wow, there's some funny stuff, or even like touching things that don't mean as much to you when you're like 7, but later is really nice.
I remember learning for the first time as a kid, like, oh, Heard It Through the Grapevine is an original song, and it's not actually about a grapevine?
Yeah.
That's just a saying?
No, we didn't know we were these sheltered white kids. We didn't know we were learning about... the career of Marvin Gaye then, but we were. Yeah,
and it was all because of raisins.
All thanks to the California Raisin advertise. Man, it's just a government subsidy that made us know about all this stuff.
You know what? Raisins, they're not good. Mm-hmm. They're not that great.
Nah, they're, look, would I say, especially one of those slimy boxes of sun-made raisins. Like,
and when you get them, it's all in one big like tumor clump of them.
Yeah,
real
yucko.
Gross.
But I'm cool with them in a cookie. They're not my first cookie I'd order, but...
Put him in a cookie. That's about it.
You know, in a hot bowl of oatmeal, I'd dribble some
sure,
in there.
Sure, yeah. Sure. They're probably not healthy either.
No, I mean, they were certainly sold as a health food when they really are just like congealed sugar that's more like natural, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess there's some fiber in the skin, but that's about it. You're better off not eating them.
Yeah, just take a fiber supplement if that's what you're into.
So the Will Vinton history is its own podcast. I can't cover everything. I'm sorry. But I can jump ahead to the end of the studio's life. So they've done music videos. They've done special effects in movies. They've done so much in their 27 years on this planet. Let's talk about the end of Will Vinton. So they lose a bit of relevance in the 90s, even though they're making a lot of money with the CGI M&Ms. Things seem to be picking up for Will Vinton Productions because they have a new process called Foamation that uses foam latex instead of clay. It's more durable. It's easier to make things and faster. The production process goes faster. And it's a much better technique. And they're like, this is our new thing, Foamation. It's still a huge pain in the ass, like all stop motion is, because you're working with real puppets on a real stage where if you bump something, the entire take is blown until you can get things back exactly where they need to be. But because of this new streamlining, Will Vinton was able to produce two television shows instead of just annual specials. And of course, these are the short-lived The PJs and the even more short-lived Gary and Mike.
Now, oh, yes.
Gary and Mike is like just above Sammy in terms of the late 90s, early aughts animation boom. Whenever we're talking about all of those, I always forget about Gary and Mike. I think it was a UPN show. It was like a raunchy road trip comedy. I think Harlan Williams was a voice in it.
Yes,
they're all
was,
on YouTube.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
all on YouTube now. But yeah, the PJs more well known because it was on Fox and had Eddie Murphy in like three seasons. Gary and Mike, just one season of that.
I did watch one episode of Gary and Mike that I happened to come across, and it was, I think the reason I didn't flip the channel was it was a gay episode, which was basically, I believe, one's a nerd and one's a cool dude, like stoner type dude, and they accidentally drive through the front of the start of a gay pride parade. And the nerd's dad saw it on TV and he's mad about it. And I just remember this funny line of he doesn't know that his dad thinks he's gay and his dad thinks that Gary and Mike are a couple. And then his dad's like calls him and says, you know, I'm so mad you did this. He's like, I know, Dad, but we're just traveling cross country. He's like, well, I hope you're at least wearing protection. And then the nerd who doesn't have sex says, well, Gary does, but I don't need to, which the father reads as because his son is the bottom, so he doesn't have to. It was a good joke. I liked that. It was a funny miscommunication.
Classic though. Gary and Mike humor.
Yes, yeah.
I want to start referencing Gary and Mike on Twitter so people think I'm crazy. Like classic Gary and Mike memes.
You know, that feel when Gary said to Mike to loosen up more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, no, the PJs, one of these days we should cover that one too, because it is Simpsons adjacent as well. And it got, it was another of those ones from the second animation primetime boom that started with King of the Hill and South Park getting big again. And
I watched quite a bit of it before it jumped to UPN or WB. I watched probably like the first season of it just because it was like, I nothing else on TV is like this.
And I mean, there wasn't, especially... Black American animation, it was very rare back then. Like, this is in the pre-Boondocks world, too. Like, PJs was kind of it in primetime back then.
Absolutely, yeah. PJs, not a success, but, you know, three seasons, whatever. Gary and Mike, absolutely not a success. Vinton needs more funding during the production of these shows because it's like, we have to make two TV shows. And we need to employ a lot of animators. Where are we going to get this money from? And this is where things start to get a little ugly because Will Vinton's lawyer knew Phil Knight, the founder of Nike, and suggested Vinton reach out to him to see if Knight would invest. And by the way, as of this recording, Phil Knight is currently the 27th richest man on the planet. Mm-hmm. So he's a fellow Oregonian. He's got a lot of money. He runs Nike. Will Vinton's lawyer is like, talk to Phil Knight. He likes to fund local businesses.
Yeah, he sure is a nice guy. I'm sure this is going to have a happy ending, this story that involves a billionaire investor.
Yes, it's always good when someone with a lot of money buys you.
I just remember Phil Knight from when I imagine him. He is featured in, man, it's the one right before Bowling for Columbine.
The big one.
The big one, thank you. Yeah, of Michael Moore, where Michael Moore comes to him and, you know, tells him, like, hey, I think it more implies that his wife guilted him into talking to Michael Moore, but he's like, hey, why don't you stop paying child labor and make your things, like, say, in Flint, Michigan? They've got all these people who want to build things. You got all these factory workers. And it's cute because, obviously, Michael Moore is, part of his deal is soft peddling an obvious, you know, thing nicely to a rich asshole. And what it happens is, like, yeah, the rich asshole says, you know, I'll think about it. And he's like, I'm not going to hire union labor when I can have child slaves in another country.
I'll give money to Democrats and you can leave me alone.
That tells me I'm a good person because I gave money to Democrats. Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, like all shoe companies, Nike is pure evil. But at least Phil Knight was like, I'll support the arts with my evil blood money, which is what he did because he bailed out Vinton's failing studio. But there's also a stipulation, like, you must hire my son. I got a quote from an article about this deal. Quote, his son Travis Knight, who had flirted with a career as a rapper, was interested in animation and might be able to contribute to his studio. Soon after the deal closed, Vinton Studios hired Travis. And here's a note for all of you out there. Travis directed Kubo, and also he directed the Bumblebee movie.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's, you know, everybody in the Transformers fandom, they say that's the best of the live action ones because it is at least more 80s, which I would guess based on his age, that's the type of fan he was.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, yes, huge nepotism there. But actually, Travis Knight is a very skilled animator. And going over the commentary, I mean, I know they're kissing, they might be kissing the ass of their billionaire boss's son or whatever. But they're like, oh, Travis did this scene and he's an amazing animator and he directs movies. So this is one case where a fail son became a success son.
Yeah.
But he got to basically do whatever he wanted because he's the son of the 27th richest man on the planet. But you can also look up his rap career online and laugh at it because it's really bad and embarrassing.
I'm going to do that. You know, this is a complex issue for our moral vision. But yeah, I mean, I don't like that an incredibly rich person can buy a company and install his kid in there. And I guess just like how, you know, you can win the lottery, every once in a very rare time, one of these fail sons handed a job actually is talented in some way and is not a complete, like, fuck up and failure. Though it's hard not to dislike him. It's like, oh, well, you got to develop your talent because you have like 8 million diamond parachutes. You can fail at anything and get every chance over and over.
You never had to get a real job, so you could spend all this time investing in yourself and learning and how to do whatever you want because you're, you know, blessed, basically.
But that is, you know, when I knew that he got a director gig later on, I wondered if it was how earned or not it was. But that is, that I like hearing that he at least has some talent at animating.
That's why this story is not as black and white as, you know, you might want it to be, just for the sake of it being an easier story to tell, because it's like, Phil, this evil money goes into an animation company, they make good things, the son is installed, he turns out to be very talented. I like the scene in the movie where the zombies are bursting out of the ground. That's Travis Knight's scene, and it's an amazing scene.
It is great. Yeah. It is great. Yeah.
So yes, Travis Knight is hired. I think he just is painting some Thurgood Stubbs puppets when he starts out. Very long and ugly battles in the press happen for the fate of the company after Knight becomes a dominant shareholder. You can go back and read news stories at the time about this battle. Vinton is very public with his hatred of Knight and how he's losing control of his company. But by 2003, Will Vinton is forced out after forming the company 27 years prior. And the very next day, the studio signs a deal with Warner Brothers to make The Corpse Bride.
Whoa.
But that kind of didn't happen because they do uncredited work on The Corpse Bride, but it is not their movie. You can read news stories that are saying, oh, Will Vinton Studios, this new person bought it, and now they're going to make The Corpse Bride for Warner Brothers. They didn't make The Corpse Bride. They worked on The Corpse Bride. I don't know who, quote unquote, made The Corpse Bride. I looked it up. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, it sounds like maybe they weren't ready to handle feature production. I mean, because Vinton had never done, no, he did, sorry, he did that creepy, at the very least there was the creepy Mark Twain one that everybody shares the clip from, that was a full feature.
And he did like these fairy tale adaptations, he did three of them that were bundled into a movie, although I couldn't find where the movie actually screened, but he did like one for The Little Prince and then two other ones that were like all 20 minutes long, but I don't know where the compilation actually exists.
I mean, I would say, you know, we talk a lot about guys like Vinton on the show, of like these guys who, you know, for better or worse, they are the top guy in their studio. And just because you're very good creatively doesn't mean you're the best at business or running a business. And I mean, I would, I hate even saying something like sideways complimentary to a shithead like Phil Knight, but I would bet this studio would not be half as successful or has made as much stuff as it was if Will Vinton was in charge of it and running it as an aging guy who probably wanted to be the lead creative on everything.
Yeah. Again, it's a very conflicting story. It's like, it's not as easy as you might want it to be because some of the evil people, their evil money became good movies.
It did. I guess this had hit the news more recently too, because there's a new documentary about this with Vinton.
I didn't have time to watch it, but it's from 2021 and I'm sure it goes over all of this, but that's a fairly new documentary.
I would have paid to rent it too, but it's like, it actually is like doing the festival circuit, so it's not available for streaming yet.
Okay.
And I bet if we pinged the people for it, PR, maybe they'd send us a free copy or a screener, but
when we do a proper Will Vinton episode, we'll definitely watch the documentary, but I just wanted to give the broad strokes of like what happened to this company, what became of it, and please no one say I'm surprised you didn't mention, because I don't have time. We're talking about Leica in this episode.
We're over 30 minutes here and we haven't really talked about Leica yet.
So postscript to all of this, after being forced out, Will Vinton forms Will Vinton's Free Will Productions, which is a real of a company name.
Hey, I'd do the same thing. So I get that spite.
But unfortunately his creative output ends up being curtailed by cancer. Ooh. He's diagnosed with that in 2006. He retired in 2008. He passes away in 2018 at the age of 70. So
sad stuff, man. That's without that cancer, who knows what his final like 10, 20 years of creativity would have been like. It's really too bad. You know, there's so many, this came up also in our Hey Arnold one, but like there's many guys like Craig Bartlett who, because they were artists and they lived in Portland, like they all did time in his studio because it was the animation studio. So even guys who didn't, like Craig Bartlett is not a stop motion guy, but he went through that system and learned so much as an artist thanks to Will Vinton having a studio there.
Yeah, the first Hey Arnolds, are those Vinton things?
They were claymation.
On Pee-wee's Playhouse, they were on that?
That's where they got, because he got his start on those Penny shorts that were also out of claymation at and Vinton Studio,
So now we're half an hour in. Let's talk about Leica. So what happens next for Leica? So Vinton is in the past. So Nightmare Before Christmas director Henry Selick joins as creative director. And then the company names itself after Leica to say, we're done with Will Vinton. And that's what Will Vinton wanted. He's like, I don't want you to run my studio after you fired me. I like, don't keep my name. So that was good. That was good for both sides.
Yeah. I mean, claymation is his thing. I would certainly be more negative towards Leica if they still called themselves the Claymation Studio or something. And I think that is a positive for them as a company of like, well, you know, let's just start over again. Like, we don't need to, we'll have the structure for this place, but let's have our own brand. And Leica is a fun name too. It's named after that, you know, sad little doggy.
Yes.
Into space.
I don't know why they named after that dog, because whenever I hear the name, I get sad. It's like, they sent the dog into space and it died a horrible asphyxiating death.
But he's a cute dog.
We can shoot him up, but we can't bring him down. I'm sorry.
Or girl dog. You know, I'm making the assumption that all dogs are boys, but
it's true. Look at the science.
And all cats are girls.
We've looked at it, folks. So Henry Selick is, hired as the creative director. He only directs one movie, and that is Coraline. And by the way, Wendell and Wild is not a Leica movie. I thought that at first, but it's not. It's his own thing.
Yeah, it sounds like one of those deals that Netflix gets out of now. But 5 years ago, we're like, hey, we can't get an exclusive Leica film or we're losing Disney and all this stuff. But what if we just gave a bunch of money to the director of those famous things? Like, we lost Nightmare Before Christmas, but what if we paid the Nightmare Before Christmas director to make a new thing for it? But, you know, from doing the research on Nightmare Before Christmas a couple of years back, I do wonder how much of a team player Henry Selick is. It's hard to make a movie. Sometimes people go 8 years without making a movie through no fault of their own, but sometimes not, and you never know.
With folks like Selick and Brad Bird, who are very talented, I have to wonder how easy are they to work with.
Yes, yeah. At least I'll admit, you know, credit to Brad Bird, like when he did that Iron Giant special edition, the extras on it have his producer saying, like, this guy's difficult. Like, I hate it.
Right, right.
Like, so he at least, Brad Bird was showing his, the warts, or at least some of the, I don't want to say warts and all, but some warts in his special features.
So, yeah, Selick is the creative director. It's named Leica now. The company is split into two divisions, one for feature films, one for commercial work. That commercial work studio would be spun off into its own company later, but they were smart in knowing that, okay, it's the early aughts, or the mid-aughts, rather. Pixar is still independent. There is room for independent animation in the world. It's not just Disney, of course, a year later. Disney
right.
devours Pixar.
Right.
But I like Leica because they're still independent, as is Aardman. That's what I appreciate about them. They have not been devoured by anyone bigger, which is why they're not on any streaming network. You have to rent their movies independently.
Yeah, it's annoying. Though this is on the Roku channel. You can watch with commercials, at least in America. And as somebody who watched the Weird Al movie on there, it's not very fun to watch things on Roku, especially a movie.
Yeah, I don't need all those ads.
Yeah.
So that happens, and the studio announces two feature films. That would be Henry Selick's Coraline and also a CGI movie called Jack and Ben's Animated Adventure, or often it's just called Jack and Ben. I don't know what the final title would have been.
Oh.
Jack and Ben was supposed to be directed by Selick pal and former Pixar employee Jorgen Klubian. But this animated film about two birds was eventually canceled, and the studio laid off 65 employees. So they went into it thinking, we can do stop motion and CGI. We're not sure if audiences really want stop motion, but it's, you know, part of the legacy of Will Vinton. But also, we know they really love CGI. It's 2005.
Yeah.
They're nuts about this stuff. Let's make a CGI movie. So that doesn't work out. 65 employees are laid off in the CGI division.
Man, you know, I can see why they would start those two projects at once as well, because, you know, this was when DreamWorks was forcing Aardman to work on Flushed Away, and they're like, does this have to be stop motion? You know, that's the Katzenberg deal not going so great for the Aardman folks. That I'm so impressed that Leica still is independent. That's not how movies are allowed to be made anymore, it feels like. Like, nobody gets to just go to a company and say, hey, we make successful movies. Give us money and we'll make one for you. And then you get to make money off that movie, and then we'll make another movie for somebody else.
Yeah, I think Focus Features distributes all of their movies, and I don't know who owns Focus Features or if they're their own thing.
I believe...
owned by Comcast and Universal.
That was it.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I was going to say, it's like, okay, Searchlight, of course, is... so it's Focus is there. There's Sony... I mean, Focus Features, too, like... I feel like that doesn't do stuff anymore. I don't know. It's a week after this comes out, it's like Leica signs deal to be bought by Viacom. Like, though Aardman seems like more likely to cash out. I keep thinking every year it's going to happen.
I hope not. But I mean, they got a Netflix deal, which is great. And doing research for this, I was like, oh yeah, new Chicken Run movie next year, new Wallace and Gromit in 2024. I'm so excited. This made me very excited about stop motion and the future of the art form.
Yeah.
So the first work that Leica puts out is a 2005 CGI short called Moon Girl. This is directed by Selick. It's their only short film they've ever made.
Oh.
And it's CGI. And it looks a lot like Coraline. You can watch it on YouTube. It's fine. But I'm sure they were just making that to test the artist and, you know, at least make something to prove they exist.
Yeah.
So,
and probably this would have been a test, too, for, like, their CGI even abilities, just to prove, like, as a proof of concept, we can make a CGI. We can be Pixar or DreamWorks as well. We can. It's not just stop motion from us.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was also, like, training people on the job outside of Portland, too. So, obviously, Selick directs Coraline for Leica. That comes out in 2009, makes double its $60 million budget, but Selick is unable to renegotiate his contract. He leaves Leica on good terms. Like, he's leaving Leica, but he's still promoting Coraline as it's being put into theaters. So, you know, there was no ugliness there.
Interesting.
And after Coraline, the studio lays off an additional 63 employees, and then they're like, we're just going to do stop motion. So, once Leica takes over, they basically lay off 120 people.
Through the
buying of the studio and the production of Coraline, they lose 120 people. So they hired a lot of people, but then they laid off a lot of people, too. So,
You know, I got to say, from the outside, just as a list of bullet pointed facts, Phil Knight takes over company, lays off a ton of people. That's, you know, it sounds bad.
Yeah.
It sounds pretty negative.
I guess they hired them in the first place, but still it's not great. But they're like, let's do stop motion. Let's do CGI. Let's not. Go away. We're going to do stop motion from now on.
I guess, sadly, that's also a cycle we're very used to in the video game world, too, of just like you staff up, then you ship your thing, and then you staff back down.
That's like every AAA game produced in the West, I think.
Yeah, very sad.
So now, 45 minutes in, let's talk about Paranorman. Now, the preamble is more interesting because the Paranorman history, not to undersell it, it's like two guys like had an idea, then they made the idea, and there's Paranorman, and they didn't do a lot before that. So it's actually like a very nice story because this is a movie directed and written by stop motion people. It's not like they brought in a screenwriter who had an idea. It's not an adaptation of a book or anything. It's like two animators got together. They teamed up within Leica to make a thing, and they made it. And it's great.
That's so impressive that like, and you don't have a Jeffrey Katzenberg figure lording over this of like, well, I think this would be a better idea. Like, you don't even on the Wallace and Gromit movie, it was like, well, the most fun to talk about is just stories of like, well, Jeffrey wanted this or Jeffrey wanted that, you know. Or same with just last month on the Transformers movie, the fun stories behind the scenes of like, no, don't kill this guy, like, fuck you, we're gonna kill him.
No Katzenberg breathing down their neck. So far, the history has been long and tortured. Again, this is very straightforward. At this point, Leica is known for spooky stop motion. And thanks to previous movies like Nightmare Before Christmas and The Corpse Bride and Curse of the Were-Rabbit, I think most moviegoers see stop motion, they think creepy stuff. That's like a natural connection for stop motion viewers. Like, of course the content's going to be creepy. These are creepy puppets dancing around.
Yeah, you know, that's, I hadn't really made the full-on like Halloween connection, but it makes so much sense, you know, even that, I believe it was Vinton as well. Those things that go bump things or like your that Halloween
was,
special.
Bump in the Night was a series.
Bump
is that
night,
it?
Yeah,
is that Vinton?
Well, it was definitely stop motion stuff that like spun off into its own series that was like, I think, candy commercials or something. But it probably helps that, like, you know, claymation and other stop motion can look very cute, but it also does have an otherworldly quality to it that makes scary things like creepier. Like, even something as sweet as one of the earliest stop motion successes of holiday specials, like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, there's still parts of it like, oh, that's creepy. Like, that's weird.
That the bumble gave kids nightmares.
Yes, yeah. That's why that Nutcracker movie that the creators, the Japanese animators made, like, is known as a creepy, or of course, like, I feel like I see it shared every 6 months, that devil scene from the Mark Twain thing. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah. It's always a fun watch, that devil scene. If you want nightmares, folks, Will Vinton can provide them. So, Coraline made them a lot of money. So, obviously, they're like, let's do another spooky thing. And this story came from the mind of writer and co-director Chris Butler, who early in his career dreamed of making a stop-motion zombie movie for kids. And his pitch was John Carpenter meets John Hughes. And that's perfect.
Wow, that really is this.
Yeah.
Man, that's a perfect elevator pitch, and it worked out great.
I can see why they bought it. So also influenced by things like The Goonies and Ghostbusters and Scooby-Doo, down to the fact that it's a bunch of teenagers in a van.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Solving mysteries. And since all zombie things feature some sort of social commentary, he thought it would be a good allegory for, like, growing up and, you know, listening to people and all that fun stuff. So he saw this as the perfect pitch for Leica. And we could talk a bit about Chris Butler here because he doesn't actually have a ton of credits. So he started as a storyboard artist on the Mr. Bean cartoon.
Oh, God.
And then moved on to being a storyboard guy on Disney's Tarzan 2. So not the most auspicious beginnings. But then he worked on Corpse Bride and became storyboard supervisor on Coraline. So that's his like career up to being the writer and co-director of Paranorman.
Man, that's an impressively quick move up the ladder for a guy like that to start on. You know, those Mr. Bean cartoons, don't they have like 800 million views on YouTube or something?
I think they're all very popular because there's no like spoken dialogue, so anyone can watch them.
Easy to watch around the world.
Yeah. And after this, he also wrote Kubo, he wrote Missing Link, and he is the writer of their upcoming movie, Wildwood. So, he really rose in ranks at Leica starting off as storyboard supervisor on Coraline. Like, I think they just saw an immense talent in Chris Butler. By the way, both these guys are very British, and because of them, I now think of the term stop-mo.
Stop-mo.
Which is what they call stop motion.
That's cute. Yeah. So, wow. So even, here I thought we were going to be talking about Americans, but even we get away from Aardman, but we still have British stop-mo people here to talk about.
And I think that's why characters have kind of British names like Norman and Alvin and maybe even like Courtney. Like, I feel like there's so many British names in this movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, now...
Perry is the dad's name? Perry?
Oh, that is... so British. Yeah. Yeah. No, actually, I mean, the amount of jokes about like corpses and stuff, and you like, I couldn't believe at first that there was a comedy scene of like a dead body, a very long one of a good person who died.
Yes.
I was like, wow, that now that I know that it comes from a British sense of humor, the darkness makes a little more sense.
That's what the movie won me over, and I was like, Pixar, where's my movie with corpse play in it?
Yes, yeah.
I've only seen one kid's movie with corpse play, and it's this one.
I want to see somebody dead, like, die on screen, and it's funny.
And you play with their corpse.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is Chris Butler. Very, very talented. The writer and co-director. The other co-director... is Sam Fells. So Chris Butler writes the script for Paranorman while making Coraline, and this is where he meets co-director Sam Fell. And Sam loved Butler's script, and they immediately joined up together to make this idea happen within Laika. And we can talk about Sam Fell here again. Like Chris Butler, not a ton of credits. This is not a slight against either guy. It just takes forever to make anything in stop motion. So you have like one credit every 4 or 5 years resume. So Fell actually came from Aardman. And he was the director of Flushed Away.
Well, okay.
So before this, Fell was a director on the Aardman TV series Rex the Runt. And he also directed an Aardman short called Pop in 1996. Again, Aardman made a ton of shorts for Oscar consideration. You probably haven't seen most of them. I know I haven't.
No, I haven't either. But wow, blimey.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Again, like these opportunities, it does make me respect Laika a little more too. That like this kind of opportunity being given to guys with these few things to even like get to write and direct. Like, I don't know. Like Pixar... they also really do promote a lot internally, and even up to like the recent Turning Red, you know, they did that. But you often, especially in their 90s and early aughts productions, you're about like, well, but they did hire this producer or this writer or whatever. Like they didn't fully trust them. Yeah.
Yeah. When Chris Butler handed in a script to Laika, they didn't say, let's get a screenwriter to help you with this. You know, that's very cute. You wrote this, but you're an animator. What do you know about telling stories?
Yeah. It's like, you know, that story on The Little Mermaid, they let the directors write the script too. But after that one, they're like, oh, this was such a great success. We're never doing that again. We're hiring real writers to screenwriters to do this from now on.
Stay in your lane, animation boys.
Don't get too full of yourself.
Sam Fell, before joining Laika, he also directed Tale of Despero, a movie I remember being pretty okay. I saw it in a theater, actually, because a friend was visiting from out of town, and I was like, that's the only thing I want to see. Let's see it. And it was fine. It was fine.
So that's the big ear mouse guy, right? So I didn't see that movie. I only knew it because... that was when I was starting in the games press a bit, and there were like 80 games for it, and I had to make the pages for it. Like, I was like, I've never even heard of this fucking thing. It looks, my feeling, I didn't give it a chance because I was like, this looks like a European thing, like like Asterix or something.
I don't know where it came from, but I remember it being just fine, not like bad, not great, but it was like, that was entertaining. And Sam Fell is currently back at Aardman. He went back to Aardman, and he is working on the Chicken Run sequel coming next year.
Oh, cool, man. I mean, Aardman's still doing great. Like that Robin, the Robin special was really good.
That was amazing, yeah.
I loved watching. I enjoyed it the way you're supposed to, at home on Christmas Day with your mom. Like
surrounded by this torn apart wrapping paper everywhere.
Yes, yeah. It's meant for the afterglow. Maybe your tummy is full of your big opulent Christmas breakfast.
Some gingerbread on top of that. Mm. So moving on to Paranorman production. I recommend you rent or borrow the DVD or Blu-ray because I'm not going to describe every featurette because there is so much information. They really want to let you know how hard they worked on all of these puppets, all of the techniques, every shot, all the lighting. you need to watch these featurettes. I can give you a few details, but I think I'm not going to be doing them justice if I say, like, oh, yeah, they worked really hard, and it was really hard to do, and boy, was it hard, because it would look so hard to do. I would never want to do this in my life.
No, I really appreciate the special features on it, and that they take such clear pride in what they do, you know, and that they want people to know. They want people to see the hands. I do think that at a lot of companies, like, God, there was that movie Rumble that, like, just got, like, pooped out onto Paramount Plus, and it's just something that, like, the animators got treated like crap on it. They all got, like, laid off. They didn't even know the film came out, and it's just, like, that's how disposable some executives can see animation work as. And,
yeah,
you know, Leica being, it probably helps being a private company that they get to have control over what's presented, and they get to talk up their abilities. I really like that. Again, I feel so complicated here, but yeah.
I mean, they really want you to know about the artifice. They really want you to see the human hands behind this. And, I haven't seen Corpse Bride and I want to, but I listened to the Blank Check about it, and they were saying on that episode about the Corpse Bride that they did some post-production process to the movie to get rid of the jitteriness of stop motion. And I feel like you're defeating the purpose of stop motion. You want to know it was made by people.
Yeah.
I think they were trying to trick kids into thinking it was CGI.
Oh, that's bullshit, yeah. Man. I didn't know. Now I look back at it, it does feel like something was off in how it wasn't off.
You know? Yeah, there should be a little bit of jitteriness on every frame. Not enough to distract you, but enough there to let you know that somebody made it with their hands. You're looking at a real thing.
I want to see thumbprints moving around sometimes.
Yeah.
I want to see, you know, it doesn't have to be the Bumble's fuzz moving all around like in Rudolph. But, you know, even that has some charm to it, at least for me. Mm-hmm.
So some basic facts about the production. It had roughly the same production size as Coraline. So like 300 to 500 people working on it at any given time throughout the course of 3 years.
Man.
So these take a long time to make, obviously. And their motto for this production was no straight lines. That's very true. From the architecture to the sets to the character designs, nothing is symmetrical. Nothing is a straight line. And it was very challenging to do that in a physical form. It's easy to draw things without straight lines, but when you're building things, straight lines make things more stable. That's why our buildings are straight lines.
Right. Oh, wow.
That's why our bodies are straight lines.
I hadn't considered why that was so, why you wouldn't want to do that, but that's amazing. Like, to know that that was their ethos, like, it totally comes through. Like, it's why everything feels just a little off. I mean, I was just admiring just, like, Norman's hair the entire movie. Like, it's also perfectly out of place, and when he even tries to straighten it and it won't, like, just, and that's just like one element of the strangeness of this world coming through.
And his hair is actually made of goat hair, and it takes 2 weeks to create. I
Holy
know this
cow.
Because there's an entire featurette about making Norman's hair.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Man.